Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We have a very special day on the morning show because we have, first of all, a familiar friend, Dr. Art Sear, director of the Clausen Center at Carthage College, and with him a very special guest making what I assume is her first appearance to the morning show. Her name is Christina Bruff, and she is an economic development officer in the Bureau of African Affairs for the U.S. State Department. And she is also a very proud Carthage graduate. In fact, studied under Professor Sear in the Clausen Center, graduating in 2004 with a double major in international political economy and economics, also minored in political science and Spanish, had a stint in the Peace Corps, and then returned to Washington. She'd been there in an internship during her time at Carthage and also had two trips abroad, so she has seen much of the world. She went back to Washington, D.C. first to work in the Government Accountability Office, and now, as I said, in the Office of Economic and Regional Affairs with in the Bureau of African Affairs for the U.S. State Department. So it is great to have her here in southeastern Wisconsin. She comes to Carthage, back to her alma mater, as its current executive in residence. And Professor Sear is going to kind of explain a little bit about what that program is all about. And then we look forward to talking with Christina Bruff about her very, very impressive career and all of the things that she has already done. And so a warm welcome to both of you. Glad to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Good to have you here. And Professor Sear, great to have you back. We look forward to your visit to the morning show, I think, next week.
Well, thank you, Professor Berg.
So say a word, if you would, about this notion of the executive in residence. And we've had several of them on the morning show, but particularly for the sake of anyone who has missed any of those previous interviews, what is this program about, and in what way does it benefit Carthage and Carthage's students?
Our Clausen Center for World Business, named after Tom Clausen, has the mission, among other things, of bringing visitors to campus who instruct not only our students but faculty and staff and the community in positive and worthwhile ways. The Chapman Executive in Residence Program is named for the Chapman family. Steve Chapman, Carthage parent, senior executive with Cummins, major global equipment company, based in Indiana, and a Carthage trustee. He and his wife, primarily as Carthage parents, endowed this program to bring executives to campus, not necessarily from the business world. And one of the things we've emphasized at our Clausen Center is to bring people from the government and nonprofit service worlds, as well as, of course, business to campus.
So how many executives and residents do there tend to be through the course of a school year?
One to two, among other visitors.
Sure.
But that seems to be a good tempo.
Right. So when an executive in residence like Christine Bruff comes to campus, then what do you keep her busy doing?
Primarily meeting with classes. And she's been meeting with a range of classes, not just in political science and international relations, but modern languages, especially Spanish. Business, finance, and others. I can assure you, and also the Carthage administration, if anyone is listening, that we do keep them quite busy, and Christina can testify to that.
Absolutely.
She's nodding her head vigorously.
As we were discussing off the air, teaching is our primary mission and one that I find quite instructive as well as inspiring. As I've gotten older, the value of bringing younger alums who are closer in age to our fine students has made a good deal more sense to me than in the past. I'm a slow learner, and it's taken a while, but on average, we are bringing younger visitors, not just because I'm getting older.
Well, Christine Bruff, we are so glad to directly make your acquaintance, and I sort of hedged the matter of you this being your first time on the morning show, because theoretically you could have joined us at least twice, because I know I've had conversations with Professor Roberg about his past trips to Cuba and to Russia and so on. But I don't think you actually happened to be along on those occasions. But it's great to have you here today. So we want to find out a little bit about you. And one of the things I want to know initially is where you come from originally, and a little bit about the path that ultimately took you to Carthage.
Oh, thank you so much again for having me on the show. It's actually been probably, according to my estimation, about 8 years since I've been on campus. It's been too long is really the answer. But I originally hail from the great state of Minnesota.
Ah,
and
where?
Just outside of the Twin Cities.
Uh-huh.
And when I was looking at programs, I was drawn to both political science and economics, and so looked at a variety of schools. And, of course, as a senior in high school, you often receive an inundation of mail. At the time, mail, more so email nowadays. But I remember getting a brochure for Carthage, and what stood out to me is that it looked like a resort on a lake. And I thought, well, that might be a nice place to go to school. So I actually wrote in, got more information, and it turned out to be a really great hook because I discovered the International Political Economy degree, which allowed me to avoid the painful decision of deciding between the two things I enjoyed the most, political science and economics. Mm. It allowed me to actually take classes in both disciplines. At the time I came to Carthage in 2000, we were really seeing just an explosion in terms of globalization and the interconnectedness of countries, not just economically, but also politically. And of course, since then, that is just mainstream understood. But at the time, it was one of the kind of newer phenomena on the global scene. And so what an IPE degree was really attractive for was allowing me to look at these in multidisciplinary ways, mm-hmm. as opposed to just saying this is a political issue or this is an economic issue.
Right. Did you have, were you pursuing that degree with any particular career path in mind?
Yes. I never had an interest in going to the private sector. I actually always wanted to go into the public sector or nonprofit. I was fascinated by the concept of poverty, fascinated by the concept of developing countries, to come from such a prosperous nation and have there be countries in the world where children die of starvation or die of diseases that I can easily go to a pharmacy to treat. That was always something that I was interested in learning more about, and I think that this degree allowed me to really go in that direction.
To explore the notion of the haves and the have-nots.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned in the introduction, you took two trips abroad while you were at Carthage, one to Cuba, one to Russia. Tell us what you remember most vividly about those two experiences.
First of all, I think one of the greatest parts of my Carthage education and a Carthage education, generally speaking, is the existence of January terms, the J terms, and the actual trips that are offered. That is not a commonplace thing to find, and I used to think it was. And when I would speak with other colleagues about their college experiences, they were, wow, that's a really neat opportunity. I consider Dr. Jeff Roberg as one of my mentors, and he knows how to get students excited. And, you know, he said, come on, let's go to Russia. And I thought, Jeff, you're crazy. I don't know how I'm going to make that happen. And he said, well, you know, look into it, see what you can do. And through a stroke of several events, I was able to come up with the money and go ahead and join him. And Dr. Penny Seymour was on the trip, and Dr. Yuri Maltsev. Fascinating doesn't even begin to describe. We went to Russia first, and then we went to the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Mm. And what was fascinating was to be able to see after the fall of the Soviet Union and as these countries have developed in their democracies and come out of this communist legacy, what challenges they've faced. Each country has dealt with it differently. Some have been more successful in some areas. Estonia is a great example of a Baltic state that has been has done very well. And so we were really able to see that firsthand. Having Dr. Maltsev, who is of Russian descent and worked, I believe, with Gorbachev, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's right, on his staff.
On his staff.
He was quite young, just before the Soviet Union collapsed.
So having him along for the trip was just a remarkable way to see the world and to really learn about it. And for as far as Cuba was concerned, I had to write a senior thesis, and with the double major and the double minor, I wanted to hit all of the topics, but didn't know how to do it. And of course, Dr. Roberg to the rescue, why don't you come to Cuba? And so I was fortunate enough to join them and to be able to see firsthand, in particular, what the impact of U.S. dollars had and has on the Cuban political and economic systems. And that's, that's what I ended up writing my thesis on. And it was a really fantastic experience. I got to use those 4 years of study and really have it culminate into something very interesting.
Mm-hmm. As you finished up your work at Carthage, what do you feel is the most significant lesson that you ended up taking away about sort of how the world is put together and the way in which sort of this vast global economic system operates? I guess maybe what I'm asking more than anything is, did you come away with anything in particular in terms of a vastly new understanding of the way all of that works?
Well, I will say, and I have said this before, that Carthage has provided me the foundation to move forward in an international career. And the way it's done that is through a liberal arts education that forced me to take classes across a wide variety of disciplines. Like I said, it's not just about political economy. It's not just about political science or the econ department. I took courses in the business department. I took a course on architecture. I took courses across the board that really underscored just how complex and interconnected the world is. Mm. And just understanding, even having a glimpse of that, between the coursework and the J-term trips and my thesis, gave me a sense of what I was getting myself into. And I think the old saying goes, the more you learn, the less you know. And I think it's easy at 18 to think, wow, well, okay, there's poverty. We need to fix that. To go from that to coming out of college going, we do need to fix it, but it's going to take, you know, we're going to need a bigger boat, as they say in Jaws. We're going to need more resources. We're going to have to think about this from multiple angles in order to solve these complex problems. I didn't know how yet, and I'm still learning, but at the very least, I knew what I was getting myself into, and I think preparing students for these real-world problems is important.
Right, not by spending all your time in a nice little hermetically sealed ivory tower.
Correct.
Just one discipline. You experienced a lot of the world in a lot of different ways.
That's correct.
We're speaking today on The Morning Show with Christine Brough, a Carthage grad from 2004, who now works for the U.S. State Department as an economic development officer in their Bureau of African Affairs. And we will talk about that in just a moment. I think it was soon after your graduation from Carthage that you entered the Peace Corps. And I believe headed off to the Dominican Republic. Tell us, first of all, having already been abroad a couple of different times, was there any particular reason why you were hungry to have that Peace Corps experience?
Yes. Well, it's funny because when I was younger, I didn't consider the Peace Corps very seriously. I thought to myself, who would ever want to go and live in a village and expose themselves to disease and poverty and bucket baths? And so I never actually, to be honest with you, until my senior year at Carthage, really seriously considered Peace Corps. But much to the point of the more you learn, the less you know, I was passionate about international development, and I recognized that I couldn't do a whole lot or understand very much from just reading a book or doing a couple of trips. And Peace Corps really provides that unique, really, quite frankly, one-of-a-kind opportunity to actually go and live in communities, to actually be at the heart of it all and live with people, learn the language. I was a Spanish minor. I came out of Carthage thinking I did a decent job of speaking Spanish. I did not. And so being able to become fluent in a language and being able to relate to a culture. And I think a lot of people look at Peace Corps as a resume builder, as something you can do to really move forward in your career. And it's true. But Peace Corps is so much more than that. It changed me as a person. It exposed my flaws, my inadequacies, my strengths, my where I can excel. And at the time, of course, I didn't fully understand what that was going to entail. But I knew I had to get out there. I knew I had to go to the developing world, and I had to see it for myself, and I had to do it in a concentrated way.
Mm. And so this really ends up being a profoundly different experience from either of those trips that you took, which were briefer. And in a sense, I mean, they were serious academic visits. But on the other hand, it's sort of the way a tourist visits a country.
Correct.
And then steps right out of it again. Peace Corps, you are immersing yourself in a different culture and for quite a lengthy time. Did anything in particular draw you to the Dominican Republic?
Well, I knew I wanted to go and speak. I wanted to go to a Spanish-speaking country. And at the time, Peace Corps didn't allow you to express a preference for a country.
Oh.
You could express a region or express kind of what kind of skills you were looking for. So it wasn't entirely clear. And as you can imagine, Spanish-speaking countries are in high demand. It wasn't entirely clear that I would get to go where I wanted to go. But when the invitation came in the mail, it was the offer I couldn't refuse. It was the Dominican Republic. It was a Spanish-speaking country, and it was their community economic development program, which would allow me to work in economic development and the very things that I was passionate about.
Were you there with anybody else? I mean, did you have other Peace Corps workers kind of shoulder to shoulder working with you?
Yes. So Peace Corps brings in their groups of folks within their various programs, community economic development, obviously one of them, health, education, water and sanitation. And the groups come in usually seasonally, and you become, I'm still lifelong friends with many of them, because you're going through this experience. The first 3 months are training, community-based training, intensive language training. You're all homesick together. You're all separating from your culture together. You're all navigating a new one together. And then for the two-year assignment, you're all spread across the country. And in the Dominican Republic, they tried to put us into at least regional kind of patterns so that when needed, we could kind of convene in a central location and commiserate and share challenges and also actually collaborate. We did a lot of projects together, cross-cutting projects. And so the professional and personal bonds that I created with my fellow Peace Corps volunteers, like I said, last a lifetime.
Right. And what kind of projects were you involved in then? I mean, what was kind of the nuts and bolts of the sort of work you did in the Dominican Republic?
Well, it was a really interesting time. In 2004, the UN had declared it the year of microfinance. And this was back when Muhammad Yunus in Bangladesh had won the Nobel Prize for his work in creating access to finance for women and women entrepreneurs. So it was quite the rage. And so a lot of our projects were focused on working with local non-governmental organizations in the country that were trying to set up similar models and trying to promote access for women to finance. And I was very excited by that. And that was something I was really looking forward to doing. And I was assigned to a Dominican Haitian sugarcane village in the southwest part of the country, which was a unique place to be, and then introduced another yet another culture and another language, and provided its own opportunities and challenges. When I was first assigned, I was supposed to be working with women's groups and helping them determine income generation activities and strengthen their business skills. I couldn't relate to them, and they couldn't relate to me, quite frankly. I was single, old in their eyes, no children, no husband, and they just couldn't understand me. They didn't, and vice versa. I couldn't understand, their life phase as well and kind of what their realities were. And so about a year, and I actually almost quit. I actually almost left the Peace Corps, and I was so frustrated. I couldn't figure out who to work with, and the first year is always hard. You're trying to get your feet on the ground. You're trying to understand your community. You're trying to understand the language. And I'll never forget, one of my youth came to me in the front lawn and said, Christina, why don't you work with us? Why don't you come and work with youth? We never have a group. Nobody ever comes and works with us. And that really defined the rest of the path of the time that I was there. I worked with youth to build their capacity to determine what their needs were, what kind of things they wanted to see in their community, strengthen their skills, their business skills, and managed to work with my fellow Peace Corps volunteers to develop basically a business plan curriculum. teaching kids how to write their own business plans, determine their needs, and then we managed to, and my I extended for a third year, and one of my projects in my third year was to go ahead and do a national business plan competition.
Wow.
And so the youth were able to compete for seed funds and be able to start up their own businesses. And what I think myself and my fellow volunteers are the most excited about is that that was scaled up and replicated around the globe in Peace Corps countries, the curriculum. So you never know what a little idea and, you know, a little bit of desperation is going to going to bear fruit for.
Well, how fascinating that here you were ready to quit the Peace Corps halfway through, and you ended up extending your stay because you found work that was so satisfying and began to realize you really could make a difference there, and did.
That's absolutely
a terrific story. You, of course, from the Peace Corps, end up, well, at what point did you go back to Washington? I think there's a master's degree in there.
There is a master's degree. So out of Peace Corps, I was blessed to be admitted into the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. That was a two-year program. I got my master's in public affairs, and I focused, again, continued the theme of development studies there. And it was remarkable. It was an incredible experience. It was a culture shock. I left the Peace Corps in July and started math camp at the beginning of August. And to go from sugarcane fields to ivy-covered buildings.
I was going to say, no bucket baths.
No, Princeton. The hot water. I just remember the hot shower and the flushing toilet were just those were the most remarkable parts of coming back. and the ivy and the scenery were just secondary to
that. So once you have your master's degree, you you head off to Washington, and your first stint there in Washington sounds so interesting to me. You were an analyst with the Government Accountability Office.
Mm-hmm.
And I know we want to focus more of our time on your current work with the State Department, but I just have to ask you about, first of all, I think a lot of us have heard about the Government Accountability Office, but I think most of us know very little beyond what the title implies. How would you characterize the work of the Government Accountability Office?
I think that's a great question, and I think more people should know about the Government Accountability Office. It's actually a office, one of the three legislative branch offices. So you have the Congressional Budget Office, you have Congressional Research Service, and then, of course, you have Congressional Accounting – or I'm sorry, the Government Accountability Office. What these three entities do is provide information to Congress. What I think makes GAO special is that we are the watchdog. We are the organization tasked to report to Congress on the efficiency, the effectiveness, the compliance with laws and policies that Congress has passed and established. And when I first learned about GAO, I was intrigued by that process of how can we make sure that the taxpayer dollars are being spent properly for the purpose for which they're intended. Are we spending money on programs that are that work? Are we removing money from programs that are not proving to be effective? And that I was certainly drawn to by the nature of the work. So I joined and found it to be really, really rewarding, incredible skill set in terms of what you do is you spend about 9 to 12 months on a topic that congressional members request. They'll come to GAO. They'll say, we want you to look at this program or we want you to analyze this policy. And you dive 30,000 feet just right into it. And then ultimately what you have to do is you have to come back up for air and write it. Very plain speak, very factual, non-biased, non-partisan, which was a very nice place to work. Really be able to say, and we had a tremendous amount of respect from both sides of the hill or both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats alike, respond very well to GAO products because they know that it's free of that bias. It's rigorously researched, rigorously fact-checked. It really is the gold standard in terms of information. So to be a part of that, to learn how to brief, how to write, how to succinctly discuss issues, very complex issues, that was fantastic. And as a plug for GAO, I want to say for every taxpayer dollar that is invested in GAO or appropriated to its budget, the return on investment is $100.
Wow.
So we find waste, fraud, abuse. We find instances of money unspent, or in non-financial terms, the benefits are numerous ways that we can improve the efficiency and the effectiveness of programs across the government.
In this particular case, I think at least your primary assignment was to study and counter-narcotics program in Afghanistan, of all places. So this was a part of the world with which you hadn't yet dealt, I don't think.
No, absolutely. So people describe GAO as the greatest dream for somebody who distracts easily and wants to jump from project to project. In the first 2 years in their development program, I rotated around the different mission teams. So I started off with an analysis of our counter-narcotics programs in Afghanistan. I did not travel there, but certainly dove headfirst into, like you said, a new region and a new topic, and it was fascinating. From there, I actually worked on a report discussing the cost implications of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. And this was during the time that policy was under review for repeal. And during the course of our review, not as a result of our review, but during the course of our review, they ended up repealing. So I jumped from that to a job auditing USDA about their efforts to prevent E. coli contamination in beef, and then ended up at the end of my 2 years coming back to the International Affairs and Trade team where I did the counter-narcotics work, and did a couple of jobs related to trade policy, North Korea sanctions, foreign aid to Micronesia and the Marshall Islands. So I covered a variety of topics, but for each project I did, I applied the same skill set and went through the same process to produce the reports that have hopefully been very beneficial to Congress. Mm.
I assume you were part of some kind of team, as each of these, I should think, fairly massive and complex assignments were tackled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually GAO, I think it's analogous to consultants' work, right? So you have a mission team full of people who work on these topics, but every time a new request comes in, small teams are assembled to take on that project. And like I said, they tend to run from 9 to 15 months. Mm-hmm. And then once you're done with your project, you go back into the pool. There's a list of projects. You bid on them, and then management determines how to assemble the next team.
Right. And I should think that part of the biggest challenge of this kind of work is trying to sort out the very best and trustworthy information you can get.
Yeah.
I mean, you could certainly pick up the phone and asked to talk to somebody who will say, oh, yeah, this is making a really big difference, versus doing the really, I should think, hard and challenging and intricate work of going a step beyond that. Mm-hmm. And not just taking somebody's word for it, but really trying to explore exactly what the reality is.
Absolutely. The art of an audit is moving beyond the testimonial evidence into finding the documentary evidence, finding the paperwork. By law, the agencies are required to respond to GAO's requests for information. Hmm. We do rely on interviews, and we do try to build a rapport. I mean, at first, you're not always warmly welcomed into room,
right,
when you're an auditor, but I think over the course of time, at least on my jobs, I've seen us be successful in building a rapport and a relationship with our agency counterparts, because you can understand the challenge. Once you start to understand the challenges, the tremendous pressures and challenges that they face in doing their work, and once they can see you, the key is to have them see you as somebody who's trying to help, trying to make a difference. And so in many instances, the best reports come out of a collaboration of sorts, where an agency or an office sees what the deficiencies are and sees this as an opportunity to report honestly about what's happening, as opposed to a threat or some sort of bad thing about to happen. And it does happen. You do get those great collaboration and work where the agency concurs with all your findings and recommendations,
right,
and takes action to improve. And those are the most rewarding types of outcomes.
And I should think that's especially challenging work to do. I mean, it's challenging enough to carry on that sort of auditing process in a place like the United States of America, let alone in a place like Afghanistan. Again, not that you yourself personally traveled to Afghanistan, but somebody was on the ground there in Afghanistan. I mean, a place that we think of as a, maybe a relatively chaotic place to live. And tracking down the paper trail and so on, I should think, is really tricky in a place like Afghanistan.
It's absolutely tricky, and it also underscores why it's absolutely essential that we do it.
Right.
We had, for a time, we did have a GAO presence in Afghanistan to help our teams in Washington collect information. And I think that's one of the greatest roles that GAO can play is to get out there. We travel pretty extensively. We actually go to the sites. I did a project on the Customs and Border Protection's efforts to enforce intellectual property rights. We went to the ports. We went out there. We saw the process. We saw the shipments come in. We saw all the fake Louis Vuitton purses and all of the confiscated material. And as an analyst and as somebody who's writing about these issues, it really hits home how tremendous the challenges are. And, for example, how many millions and millions of dollars of goods come into our ports, and how do you screen that? How do you do it effectively? How do you protect the border? When you go out there and you actually get to see it, you start to really understand the challenges that these agencies
face. It's not just a matter of building a wall. I'm going to write that down. This is a good insight. Never knew that before.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Christine Brough, a Carthage graduate who now works for the U.S. State Department. We've just been talking about her stint with the Government Accountability Office, and now we're going to spend the last portion of our conversation talking about her work as an economic development officer. So you were saying that in the Government Accountability Office, it's ideal for someone who likes to kind of hop from project to project to project. So what sort of impelled you then to pursue what sounds like a very different assignment? Which requires, I should think, sort of longer-term focus.
Absolutely. Well, I was always passionate about the State Department after my experience as an intern during my years at Carthage. It really set the tone for my interest in international affairs. And I was in the Bureau of International Organization Affairs and worked with UN agencies, technical agencies. And that was a phenomenal experience. So I always knew I wanted to get back. And as I've explained to students, sometimes you're like a hermit crab rather than, you know, scaling a mountain. You're moving to the side, you're moving up, you're moving down, you're moving across, and you never know what this career journey is going to bring you on. After 5.5 years at the Government Accountability Office, I was ready for a change. I was ready to get more into, rather than analyzing the policy, I wanted to get into the policymaking aspect. And I was fortunate enough that one of my colleagues from when I was an intern alerted me to an opening and said, "Do you want to throw your resume in?" And I said, "Sure. I don't have a whole lot of Africa background. In fact, I had no zero Africa background. But like you said, had acquired a bunch of skills and interests and ended up getting an interview and interviewing with my current boss, and he hired me. And it's been a remarkable year thus far. I just celebrated a year in this position. And it's a stretch position in the sense that, you know, I have the skills and I have the base, but now I have to learn the region and I have to learn the countries. And our bureau covers 49 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And our office covers all of the issues, cross-cutting issues that impact those countries. So it's not just I'm coming on and I'm going to be the Zimbabwe desk officer. And so my job is to know Zimbabwe. I have to know a little bit about everything, which as a generalist in my career has been something I've had to do anyways.
Right. So. Well, and of course, we're talking about a continent that is especially complex. I mean, it's a much larger continent than most Americans realize. And when you think about the diversity of that continent, that's also something that probably is lost on most of us Americans. You've probably had to learn that firsthand. What is your most critical work as an economic development officer? It sounds a little like what you were doing in the Dominican Republic. Is it something roughly akin to that?
There are similarities. It's certainly more at the 30,000 foot level as opposed to the grassroots level.
Right, right.
What I really enjoy about my work is I get to, again, look at those cross-cutting issues. What my purview includes is, in particular, last September, President Obama, on behalf of the United States, along with the other 193 countries in the United Nations system, agreed to and adopted the Sustainable Development Goals. These are 17 goals that are intended by 2030 to tackle an array of development challenges, one of which is to end extreme poverty, a hugely ambitious goal, promote gender equality, end hunger, increase education, battle climate change and the impacts of climate change. There's just 17 goals and really, really ambitious targets that go along with that. It's an exciting time to be looking at development and how we move forward, how we continue to make progress. And in particular, Africa as a continent has a vested, many of these issues are very salient and very prominent on the continent. To your point about Africa as a continent, I think we are undereducated as a populace about what it is. I think everybody has in their mind, kind of, we almost talk about it as if it's a country, Africa,
right.
That
right.
Place over there, Africa. And to your point, I mean, 49 countries. We don't look at North America and say, oh, North America, all of those people. Absolutely not. The diversity is incredible. You have major world languages, Spanish, French, English, French, along with all of the indigenous languages that are spoken. You have Christianity, you have Islam, you have indigenous religions. You have just a tremendous variety. And as you said, the sheer size of the continent itself.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is it's not just about rhinos and elephants and safaris. It's dynamic, exciting and interesting people. And it's not just about women with buckets on their heads. It's about women who are businesswomen and entrepreneurs. And Kenya has a stock exchange. Accra, Ghana bills itself as the financial capital of West Africa. I mean, Africa's on the move. I mean, that's what President Obama always says. And I think he's right. There's a growing middle class. There's more and more youth. Almost half the population is youth. And so there's just a huge amount of promise and a kind of a dynamic environment that I think people overlook when we just look at it as this place and don't necessarily see the incredible variance on the continent.
So is your work, you and your colleagues, primarily to help foster economic development in Africa?
That is one element of what we do. The presidential policy directive sets out the U.S. strategy towards sub-Saharan Africa, and it focuses on four priorities, one of which is to help strengthen democracies. We want to see fair, open, free elections on the continent. We want to see peaceful transitions of power democratically established. The second priority is economic growth and trade and investment. To your point, it's also very important. The third priority is to advance peace and security. And as you know, there, with Boko Haram in Nigeria and al-Shabaab in Somalia, preventing violent extremism is a big priority of ours. And the fourth priority is promoting opportunity and development. And that's more so where my portfolio lies, of course, with the Sustainable Development Goals, but also I work extensively on women, peace, and security. I manage a $2 million grant that provides funds to non-governmental organizations in Africa to help promote women's participation in peacemaking, in political processes, running for office, getting them at the table during peace talks, also looking at ways that we can prevent gender-based violence, female genital mutilation and cutting, all of the various issues that women face, as well as conflict prevention and access to relief and recovery. And so those are the vast array of things I work on, but the ones that I'm most passionate about.
In some ways, it feels like you're on the other side of the table in the sense that you're trying to enact programs and so on, the kind of thing that at some point the Government Accountability Office might come along and you'll make sure, is this effective? Is this achieving? Am I missing something?
No, you are. You actually, it's funny you say that. I believe it was 2 months after I arrived. I was invited to a kickoff meeting for an audit related to female genital mutilation and cutting. And I was the Africa Bureau representative. And when I walked in the room, I was sitting across from my former boss. And
wow.
He said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I am responding to your audit." So I actually worked with former colleagues to help gather data and contribute to their report. So it's very funny you mentioned that, because once you move over to a different agency, you can probably expect a knock on the door from your fellow colleagues.
Interesting. And so now, in a sense, you understand even more the work you did there, because now you're, in a sense, on the receiving end of it.
Correct. And I can also understand what it's like to have an auditor sit across from you in a way that I didn't before.
Absolutely. Fascinating. I assume that the work that the Bureau of African Affairs does is occurring in those African nations which, in a sense, want us there. I mean, you don't break the doors down of some nation with which we might be politically or diplomatically estranged. And you go, your programs go, in a sense, where they are welcome, right?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. We have partnerships across the continent. Our embassies are located in countries, and we reach out and work very closely with host governments to implement policy or programming, and that is critical. We can't just go in and do things without buy-in, without considering what it looks like in that context. And so it's critical that we have the collaboration and buy-in from our counterparts, as well as engaging with civil society, non-governmental organizations that are operating in the country. Many of our programs are informed by a variety of viewpoints, but obviously our bread and butter business is to work with host governments and do the work of diplomacy in that regard.
Hmm. I should think that it's also a kind of a complicated matter in terms of those nations that matter a lot to us, I mean, for various reasons, versus other African nations that, in a sense, strategically are not particularly crucial. But it sounds like the work that you do has kind of a sweeping nature in which this is not just about bolstering our own allies, but about reaching out in a very genuine way to try to make life better for a wide swath of Africans, no matter where they live.
Absolutely. I think we are non-discriminant in the way that we seek partnerships with all African countries and all 49 of them. Again, to your point, it's a collaborative process, and it's helping understand the context that and the challenges that each country faces. Certainly, there are cross-cutting issues, thus the existence of my office. But the way that we execute those policies and we collaborate on projects really does vary by country. I think we've recognized, kind of going back to the lessons learned from my Carthage education, there's an interdependence among countries that I think precludes us from saying, okay, I'm only going to work with this country. I'm not going to work with that country. There's important regional connections, in particular in the African context. Yes, there are boundaries that have been drawn, but that does not mean that there aren't ethnic groups or issues that spill over, that cross borders, that transcend our concept of political boundaries. And we need to be sensitive to that and understand that it's more important in many ways to work with every country to work on those common issues, as opposed to say, well, we're only going to work in this place or that place. Right. And I think that our approach, particularly on things such as trying to get energy to Africa, for example, Power Africa, how do we get electricity? That's an issue that each country is struggling with. Infrastructure, health, fighting corruption. That's not just a one country thing. Those are issues that affect all countries, and we stand ready as a partner to do that.
What is your sense of where Africa is headed? And I ask that question mindful of where this conversation began, that there's something, in a sense, almost kind of ludicrous about talking about Africa as though it is
fair.
One thing, one entity. Nevertheless, what's your sense of where Africa, given all its complexity, is headed?
I think it's a continent of tremendous potential, and I think there's a huge energy that we in the Bureau are certainly very excited about, and we try to promote to others. There's no better time, really, for American businesses in particular to look into investments there. You have a tremendous population. You have, I think they're at, by 2050, we're looking at a population of 2 billion people on the continent,
many of which
are youth. And that kind of dynamism and energy is just essential. We are working with increasingly promoting women entrepreneurs on the continent. Last year, Congress reauthorized the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which allows preferential trade between African countries and the United States so that they can export goods. And we've incorporated gender as a part of that legislation that will allow women to move from the informal economy to the formal economy. And then those of them that have managed to come up with these finished products can gain access to the markets. Mm. And that's just one example of just the incredible dynamism and potential that the continent has. I also think that we're finding more and more that we're seeing democracies become established in fits and starts, which often, if we look in the history of democracies, that's apt to happen. But for example, last year in Nigeria, we saw the first peaceful transition of power in that country. And it was just landmark. And particularly Nigeria's position as one of the biggest economies and one of the powerhouses of the continent. It's an example. And we've seen successful, similarly peaceful, open, fair, transparent democratic elections in Burkina Faso, in Cote d'Ivoire, in West Africa. And we want to see that momentum continue, because we know that when we see stable, functioning democracies, we can also see stable, functioning economies that are attractive to investors, but businesses can come and invest and have a strong sense of confidence that their investments are going to be honored, and there's going to be, you know, we're continuing to work. There's challenges ahead and trying to establish strong institutions that can support economic development and help kind of this growing middle class of Africans access jobs and products. And at the end of the day, the same thing that we as Americans want for our children: education, opportunity. It really is a really fantastic time to be around and seeing what's moving on the continent.
Well, how exciting for you to be part of it. And Professor Seer, it must be so exciting and gratifying for you to see a Carthage graduate from your own Clausen Center doing what Christine Bruff is doing.
Well, it should be a source of pride for all of us that our center is effective in this way and another way, since so many of our students and the public at large is interested and focused on business these days. One suggestion would be, as you're reading the business press, look at the amount of investment, private capital, pouring into Africa, engineering, construction, consumer product. Coca-Cola has made a huge recent investment. Take a look, for those of you who see yourself as practical women and men, take a look at the amount of capital going into that area. Starting with George H.W. Bush, we have given sustained attention to Africa. That is a huge change, except for Carter, who had fantastic focus and effectiveness in the White House and since, and John F. Kennedy, who was chairman of the African Affairs Subcommittee of the Foreign Relations Committee. We really did ignore Africa, as Christina was saying.
Not anymore.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And that is a strategic change. The Chinese have been there since the height of the Cold War and the Sino-Soviet split. The Chinese, not just lately, but the Chinese have a huge investment of political and human as well as infrastructure capital.